Joe. I've got tapes and things on there.
Are those the originals?
Yeah, they are originals. This is the pop song original master tape.
Have you got anything to play on?
No.
You shouldn't be touching it.
I was knowing that's my knee wasn't in the way. I'm a professional, Paul. I knew what to do. It's the greatest story ever sold.
Head in hands and violent temper. Okay.
Episode 5.
Resilience. A life in care. A personal podcast series. By Tony Simpson.
It's been a while.
Indeed it has, perhaps too long. But welcome to the fifth in my series of podcasts, where, together with my friend and radio producer Paul, I'm going back over my life in care, all part of Bernardo's oral history project.
In the last episode, you left school, you left Bernardo's.
Yeah.
And you struck out on your own.
Yeah, yeah. I spent all my life from birth until I was 16 in institutions. I was born in a Salvation Army mother and baby unit, and I went into Bernardo's at the age of 3 months. And I remained in their care until legally I became an adult. These experiences are all dealt with in the first 4 episodes of this podcast series. It's in this instalment that I make that difficult transition from care to adulthood. And in my case, it's a story of 3 parts, 3 obsessions, if you like. Music.
Do you know, Paul, we had our first single out when I was 16. Jesus.
Football.
We used to play a team of Rastas called HIM. His Imperial Majesty or something.
And they'd go to me, man, what are you playing with these white boys? I go, mate, I'm from Shirley, what can I do? And finding the right kind of work. Actually, Paul, I was so institutionalised. When I left school at 16, I tried to become a boy soldier. I went to the army. And I remember a friend of mine saying, Tony, all you're going is from one institution to another. And thinking, yeah, you're probably right. And I was saved. I've got a lazy eye. And I wanted to join the Royal Corps of Transport. They wouldn't let me because I've got a lazy eye. And they said, we can join the regulars. And I thought, oh, no, I don't want to be a regular private. Thank you very much. It's true. Institutions. With very few exceptions, leaving the care system is a traumatic time. The blow for me was cushioned by living with a foster family in what was my first family home. But for many, that isn't always an option. It was at this stage in my life that I found the resilience I'd built up through years of living in institutions now helped me overcome the fear of a future cast adrift, but with no provision for failure. I was like a caged bird, suddenly released, flying high and hard, without a destination or somewhere secure to land and take stock. I now realise that emotionally, I was always on the move, not looking back, but afraid to look forward, always living in the now.
Once you'd left Bernardo's, mm-hmm. once you'd left school,
yeah.
and you moved into this new world,
yeah.
you didn't tell them about your backstory.
No, not at all.
So Bernardo's is a bit of a secret.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
And when did you start talking about it?
When did I start talking about it?
Yeah.
Not until very recently, when I was 55. Honestly, Paul, I didn't talk to people about it until the last... When we put the first teaser out, most people know me, that was it. They were shocked. Even people I know well, I would never tell, because then I have to explain everything. Because if you say, oh, I grew up in Bernardo's. Why did you grow up in Bernardo's? Because, oh, well, where was your mum? Well, why didn't she have you? And it's, really? Do you know what I mean? It's just like... As I said, one of the reasons I'm doing this is because I know it's important for people and I dismiss it sometimes as being nothing, but it's not nothing. And it's also, I have been able to navigate my way through that. And I've seen people not able to do that for various reasons. And it's important to try and get that balance. And that's why I've come back to Wellmore Road and the small Bernardo's group home that was the focus of my life until my time at Bernardo's came to an end. Going back there with Paul whilst making this series was the first time I'd been back in decades.
Did you have to leave here to become yourself more?
Yeah. It wasn't until I left here that I think I could start to develop my own personality. I was still shaped by that building and shaped by everyone's expectations for me from living in that building and all the people I live with, which is very different to my reality.
When he knew he was leaving school, to me, that was when he grew up and suddenly took a hold on his own life.
That's Jill Harrison, my house mother at Wildmoor Road. She came into my life when I was 11, and I'm still in touch with her today.
He went out at 16, and he said, I've got a job. He'd only left school on the Friday, but he got a job to start on the Monday. And he was an apprentice carpet fitter at Allied Carpets.
Yeah, I did. And I'd love to have been an apprentice carpet fitter. Unfortunately, I was a porter, but there you go. I did do that, but I didn't have a choice. Oh, my gosh, this car park is always here. There used to be a loading bay for all the lorries to come in. And where I'm parked now, all the fitters, carpet fitters, used to have their vans. And in the morning, they'd call them all in one by one. We'd put four or five big rolls of carpets in the back with their gripper rods and underlay, their carpet bags and Stanley knives, and off they'd go to fit carpets into Shirley. And I used to think, God, I'd love to be a fitter. I'd love to be in one of the vans all day. And then the lorries would come in there in the back here and I would unload them. But it's weird to think I did this for 5 years, Paul. It's a long time.
Jill talked about how when you left school on the Friday, you went out and got a job, which you started on the Monday.
Yeah.
That wasn't this, was it?
Yeah, it was Allied Carpets. I got on my bike, actually. I cycled up to this place called Cranmore Boulevard at the top of Shirley, where all the factories are, and I knocked on the doors. In those days, you wouldn't have a CV. Have you got any work? Have you got any work? And nobody had any work. And on the way back, I was just going into shops, asking, have you got any work? And I came in here to Allied Carpets, and they said, yeah, we're looking for a porter. And porters in those days were young lads who used to roll up the carpets and put them into people's cars once they bought them. Or you'd be in a warehouse driving stacker trucks and putting the carpets into the right bays. Made you quite strong and fit. And they said, yeah, you can start this week. So I started. I was in here. I was a porter.
Did you have any aspirations when you left school? I mean, what did you want to be?
I remember there was a block of flats in Shirley on the edge of an estate. And I always thought, God, it'd be great to have a flat there. My own flat. That was my aspiration as an adult. You know, I had no ambition of a career. I didn't know what a career was, actually. In those days, a lot of people would go to the Rover and 30 years later, they'd still be there and they made it up to foreman. That would be great. For me, I didn't get an apprenticeship, so I didn't have that security. I just thought, if I get a job here, I'll see what happens.
Can you remember the first day, your first work day?
Do you know, I think for me, it would have been really strange because I think my first work day would have been the first time I'd been in an environment where there were lots of dominant white males. Thinking about it, at school we had teachers, but the teachers were abroad. But this is suddenly I was in a work environment, which is a very testosterone-filled environment. I was the first person of colour in the organisation, for starters. In fact, it's quite horrible, actually. I do remember it. When I first started here, I was young, I was 16. I remember them walking around going, God, can you smell anything? I knew they were talking about me, actually. And I just let it go. And I thought, yeah, whatever. But actually, the guy who was with me, just ignored that person who was saying it as well. And that was really big of him, actually. But I remember thinking then and there, gosh, I've got to bring people round to liking me. And I have to say, when I left, I was hugely popular. And I think some of the people who made those comments would be ashamed. But yeah, they did say them.
And did that change? I mean, you became popular, but those sort of attitudes, that sort of talk, did that change?
No, what happened was, when people joined, they sometimes have that attitude, but I'd noticed that other people wouldn't stand up for me, but they wouldn't encourage it. Does that make sense? So I think in a strange way, I had a sort of, not a protective bubble, but people were just like, no, Tony's all right. No one would actually say that, but if somebody made a racist comment, nobody would pick up on it. And in the end, they'd feel a bit, oh, okay. And I'd always let it go. That was my working environment. But you have to remember that was in the time when it was quite institutionally bad in England. I had to take a job. I knew I had to get a job. And so I was really pleased to have that job and I'd probably put up with anything. And it was fine. It wasn't nasty, but, you know, that's what it was. And in fact, just coming back to me now, over there was the police station. And so because people sort of knew me in Shirley, every 6 months, police would come in uniforms into the store and ask for me to go into one of their lineouts because they might have somebody of colour, and I was the only person they knew. So I've been in so many police lineups. I'm just a guy working across the road, yeah. Certainly wouldn't do that now. Not that I'm talking about racial stereotyping, but that was me.
So at that time, mm-hmm. how big an issue was racism in your life?
I tell you what I remember. I remember Jill Harrison saying to me, Tony, whatever you do, you've got to be 4 times better than anybody else going for any job.
Oh, yes, because of the environment, the area in which we lived.
Yeah, of course.
I like carpets. I don't think I'd ever employed a black man before. Certainly not his solely all the end. Oh, surely.
So I became what people wanted me to be to get the jobs. I worked really hard, genuinely, really hard. I also struggled a bit because I think I was, I was quite bright when I was younger, and I think some people didn't like that as well. I actually didn't think I was very clever. And the light bulb moment for me came when I'd been working at Allied. I'd been there about 4 years. I had an accident. I don't know what I'd done, but I hurt my hand. And there's a doctor's surgery behind the carpet shop. I might have cut myself with a Stanley knife, actually. And the doctor was saying, oh, so where do you work? And I said, I work at Allied Carpets. He said, oh, what do you do? And I said, I'm one of the porters. Why are you there? Why don't you go to college and do something else? I'm thinking, what do you mean go to college? I thought, oh, my God, the doctor thinks I'm clever. Nobody at school ever said that. And in my head, I always thought, perhaps I can do more than this. And it honestly sounds old now. You know, I spent 4 or 5 years there. So from 16 to 20 is a long time. You know, it's a time that people going to university or sixth form. I was doing my music. I've not thought about this, but when people were coming back from university who I'd met through my music and getting jobs, and I was still there doing the porter. And I thought, oh, is this my job? And also, I always wanted to wear a shirt and tie and be a salesman as well. And, you know, I was never given the opportunity to be a salesman in the shop. Yeah. I was probably a lippy porter at the back. When he said, was I happy? I wasn't miserable, but I wasn't happy. It was just because I actually had a job and I was quite pleased with that. But I honestly thought that would be my lot in terms of any sense of career. But I didn't have a career. I had a job and that was it. I never thought beyond the time I was working there. I didn't think about what I'd be doing next year. I just wanted to be in a band in those days. I wanted to make music. Some of the people who worked there used to come and see me sometimes. And I'd be quite pleased with that because they'd see me in a different light. The police are still around here, which is good. This is the second time we've played this piece of music in the podcast. So let me tell you what it is. It's called The Pop Song by a group called O2-1. Something's never changed or stayed the same. And yes, the person singing it is me. We did quite well, releasing our first single in 1979 and building up a reasonable fan base. But for 4 or 5 years, it was almost all that I lived for. It's the greatest story ever sold. Head in hand to vine to go.
Yeah.
God, blimey. That's a great venue, the Mermaid.
It was a fantastic venue, the Mermaid, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was, yeah. I've come to the Birmingham Music Archives to meet with Jez Collins and to try and better understand what music meant to me at the time.
I'm going to go through these now and I'm going to pick out ones that I think will be of the time that Tony was around.
This one is my time. Nightingales, Terry and Jerry. I played with Terry and Jerry. If music was my obsession in my later teenage years, it's nothing compared to Jez's dedication to the Birmingham Music Archive, which he set up and continues to run from his offices in the trendy area of Digbeth in Birmingham. For him, it's not so much about the actual music, but more about its cultural, social and historical significance. But that is a great narrative, isn't it?
It is a great narrative, great visual collection. For me, you know, if we don't collect these things, then for me, we don't know about Tony and the music that he made. And it doesn't matter if it's successful. I mean, how do you measure success anyway? Yeah, but it doesn't matter if it's culturally important. It's of a time and it tells a story of a city. How does a black guy end up in a punk group in Solihull? Right? And if you don't collect and tell these stories, we lose them. How do we then influence and inspire future generations? All my work is about looking up and saying, he looks like me, she talks like me, they dress like me, they sound like me.
And that's why I do the things I do. I mean, it's a big job,
yeah.
One, to celebrate and to say, you know, this city is of worth, culturally is of worth, and look at the things that have come out of it. But also to say, look, you know, don't believe it when people tell you Birmingham's a shit, grey, concrete, soulless place. There's so much vibrancy and culture going on. And look, at these are the people who've created these things, and you can go and do it too.
Yeah, Jess, I remember hearing Young, Gifted and Black, and I must have been about 14, 15, and I just like froze.
Yeah.
I'd never heard of positive reinformation of being black,
yeah.
And young,
yeah.
And I'd heard it on a record,
yeah.
And it was a great piece of music,
yeah, as well.
And I thought music is just a beam of light. Yeah. Music and being the front person of a band opened up a whole new universe of possibilities for me. It was something I needed spiritually, where I would be judged on merit, not on perception. I was fortunate. My teenage years coincided with the emergence of punk rock, and it was something I could do. I had a band of brothers, an outlet, a voice. I could emotionally discharge without it having to be personal. Actually, musically, people were listening to Peter Frampton, Frampton Comes Alive, but it didn't mean anything to me. And then my then now new neighbour, a guy called Ian Richards, came over one day with a Clash single, Tommy Gun, and said to him, what do you think of this? Actually, I first thought, we could do that. And so Ian said, I've got some drums. And I was like, right, OK. And I'd done singing when I was younger in a choir. And a guy called Martin Frayne, who also lived at the road. And Martin could neither sing at the time or play an instrument. He can now. He's a very good guitarist. And Martin said, look, I've got a couple of guys at school who can play rhythm guitar and a bass guitar. And so we co-opted two guys with very long hair, one into Hawkwind. So trust me, our first gig was an eclectic mix of Iggy Pop, Wanna Be Your Dog, followed by Stephen Wolf's Born to Be Wild, followed by The Clash, Police and Thieves. Trust me, it was bizarre. And we'd been doing that for about a month. And then somebody at the sixth form, who was a friend of Martin, said, look, we're putting an album together. If you've got a couple hundred quid, you can be on it. I think it cost us all £20 each, which is quite a lot of money then. Now, I was working at the time, earning my £13 a week. I thought, yeah, I could probably get that down. So I, along with other people, used paid weekly, were putting money into the single. And then we were so naive, I have to tell you, that we went to the studio and thought, we'll rehearse 3 minutes, record it for 3 minutes, I'm sure they'll mix it and then we'll go. So I thought it'd be 15 minutes and there were four bands, so we booked the studio for an hour. I kid you not. Anyway, so the three of us recorded this piece of rubbish, actually. I say that in as much that I would like to say it was art, but it wasn't. We did the most and the best we could do, produced Robot. I remember thinking, this is just awful. We put it down on our record player. It was dreadful, and we tried to be really good. And the reason why I think it's brilliant is because we couldn't play, none of us ever recorded anything, and yet it was the very essence of punk, and that's why it's a collector's item now. Some strange quirk of fate, we sent it off to Radio 1 and John Peel played it. But actually, it was the realisation, thinking, oh my God, we're keeping David Bowie off the airwaves for 3 minutes. It is about what you've got to say rather than how you say it. And suddenly we started to believe that we being, you know, not just us, other people, that you could make music and express yourself. And it really made us think, gosh, you know, if I can do it, you can do it too. And that was a spurring moment. We thought, this is what I want to do. This is who I want to be. I was going to be myself, and I could value myself by being this singer.
Well, of course, there will be those who will say, only Peely could play that. And if that's the case, then I'm jolly proud of it is the case too.
So for the next 4 years, I threw myself into music and the band. They infused every waking moment. I listened to everything. I devoured contemporary fiction, autobiographies, black history. I extended my friendship group, visited art centres, and culturally enriched myself. The whole thing was about the journey. It wasn't about being a great band, because we were never a great band. What we were authentic and genuine. We were genuinely bad, but authentically cared about it at the beginning. And I think that's the important thing. After a period of time, the music became more significant than the band. We released better singles, played better venues, and previous musical heroes became peers.
It's not as bad as I thought it would be.
Well, we were actually paying. People were watching us, Paul. We were a proper band.
But even taking out the music, it's about documenting that culture of that time. Yeah. And Solihull was quite an interesting one.
Yeah,
Solihull, for people who listen to might not know, is in Birmingham considered a posh area. So the last thing you'd imagine was a bunch of punks coming out of here. But, you know, it was home to Genesis P. Orridge.
Yeah.
It was home to the Swell Maps, who were one of the very early punk bands who I think were a great influence, not just in Birmingham, but across the board. And then you had O2-1, then you had GBH, you had the Accused, the Spears. It's a fairly white, or it was at the time, a fairly overwhelming white population. But it had these, I guess, you know, I wasn't around at the time, but I'm guessing it was just punk infused people and that whole thing with John Peel. For me, there is no bad music, I have to be honest. You know, there's music I listen to, music I like, but I can never see how music can be bad. But the idea that people just were so enthused to pick up a guitar, a microphone, and just go and record it, that's the important thing, because that shows socially and culturally and politically what was going on at that time. That's why it's really important to have things like, you know, O2-1's, you know, music now available. And I think the music actually stands up as a record and as a journey. You can see, as I say, the evolution musically of the band and the songwriting. I wouldn't say that just because he's standing here. I would be honest.
No,
I wouldn't have bought it otherwise.
No, I'm comfortable with it. In as much, you're right. It was a journey, and it was quite early on. And I think I'll tell you something that's really interesting. Solihull was two areas. A lot of the bands were quite working class in an area where some of the people watching us weren't. So there was always a gap between us, the musicians, and some of the audience watching us. Actually, that's not true. Because actually half the guys came from Solihull School. I mean, Swell Maps, Spears and all these guys did. But they were different. They were quite art school. Whereas, you know, GBH, ourselves, Undertakers weren't actually.
But that's true of punk in general, you know.
But you don't have to be poor to have a voice, that's the point.
No,
do you know what I mean? And I think, but people were different. It was a leveller.
You said this is what you want to do. Was there a time when you might have made it?
After the pop song had come out, we were due to be managed by Duran Duran's management company, and they were talking about getting us a slot on their, I think it was Planet Earth tour. Our manager said we got the slot, and I really believed we got it. I remember going to the pub. Our singles were on the jukebox in Solihull. The local pub was called the Captain Locker. My great pickup line in those days would be, you know, sort of talking, oh, yeah, good song, yeah, that's me. Yeah, no, it's not again. No, it is. It really is. I loved it. Never happened again, Paul. It's the greatest story ever sold. Pop song did get Radio 1 airplay. You certainly got a few royalties. And I decided to act a bit differently to people and thought, yeah, this is going to be it. There was a window of 6 months where, yep, I had no doubt whatsoever we'd make it. And I'm breathing fast and running to the telephone. Then nothing happened. We didn't get the promised support slot with Duran Duran and Hazel O'Connor, and lots of venues were closing down, and then it was a drag, oh, we've got to go play somewhere else. And in the end, apathy. But I remember there used to be a rehearsal studio on Stratford Road. I forget what it's called. It's a really small one. Above Vale Onslow. There you go. People all know if they know what Vale Onslow is.
Yeah.
It was above Vale Onslow, which is an old motorcycle shop in Birmingham. And we used to go there every Sunday afternoon. And there used to be a band called, I think they were Starfighters. And they were a rock band from Birmingham. And we'd been rehearsing. And what would happen is you'd take 3-hour slots and we're just finishing. Another band were coming in. So we're going out. And these guys were coming in. And I thought they were ancient, by the way. They're all in the mid-30s. And we were probably 22, 23, 24. And I was saying, where have you been? He said, yeah, man, we just come back for a 5-day gig. We did Denmark and we did X, Y, and Z. And I was going, great. And he said to me, yeah, man, I just love the music. I said, that's brilliant. He says, yeah, I'm 35. I just got divorced, but mate, I'll always have this. And I remember thinking, I'm never going to be you. And I don't mean in a nasty way, but I just thought, no, I need to own my narrative and own my story. I didn't want to be a slave to this quest for I don't know whether it was fame, which I don't think it was, but this quest for something that I felt was unattainable. And so I don't know if it was cowardly or not, I just turned it off. I just said, no, I'm not doing this anymore.
Was it that music for you just died away?
No, I did what I do with a lot of other things. I just put it in a box and carried on. And never really went back.
You'd done it, basically.
Yeah. I treated it like that.
It was a project?
No, because at the time it wasn't a project. It really was. It was heartbreaking to, I know it sounds old, for me to not do it, it was really heartbreaking and sad. But music, actually, I used as a lever to believe I could do other things in life. I never thought I could make a record. And then we did. I never thought we could play at Solihull Civic Hall, and we did. Never thought we could play in Birmingham, we did. Never thought we'd play in London. You know, I remember the day we played the Cavern Club, thinking, oh my God, we played in Cavern Club in Liverpool. But then you think, well, so what? Where's it all leading to? And going back to my whole thing in life, this is me personally, all I ever wanted really was just to have a family and be a dad. I knew enough to know that to be a successful musician would give you a weird life that would be as unsustainable as if I'd have been something else.
Yeah, like the guitarist in Starfire. Starfire,
yeah. That was the shock. It was a realisation that this isn't going to get for you what you want it to be, which is, I don't know, it wasn't going to be being a full-time musician, really. It sounds terrible. But I got into football and started playing football, and I just needed to get on with my life, really. There was a point in making this episode where we thought we can't include everything. Maybe we should drop the football element, or at least Paul thought that. No, don't leave it out, and I'll tell you why. Because football was the bridge to me leaving music. The team came from music. It was really important to all of us.
Yep, is that better?
All of us included Colin Abrahall, who'd gone to the same school as me. This was the first time we'd spoken in 28 years, and because of COVID, it had to be via video, with him recording his own end of the conversation.
Oh. I'll hold it there. Like I'm casually smoking a pipe or something.
Colin is better known as the lead singer of the international renowned punk band GBH, still going strong after more than 40 years on the road. Cole, I saw in a chart you're voted, Mike, the 14th or 15th most influential punk band of all time, mate.
The 14th?
No, look, mate, I'm talking Damn, Pistols, everyone. I'm talking forever, ever. Mm. I'm quite proud of that, mate.
Yeah.
Personally, because you're like, you know, homeboy. As I look back now, I can see that I'd swapped one passion for another. Like a shark, I needed to keep moving, trying to achieve something that was unattainable. The drive to do this came from my original insecurity and fear of standing still. It was the same obsessive personality with a built-in dynamo installed at Wildmore Road, but with football instead of my music as my focus of excellence. In the team were members of other Birmingham bands, as well as people we'd known and grown up with. And my new obsession was to turn Tinseltown FC from this raggle-taggle bunch of musicians and creatives into a serious team.
As I remember, we used to have a kickabout on a Tuesday or Wednesday at JC Park.
Yeah, we did.
I was thinking about it earlier, and it's a bit like forming a band.
Yeah, it was.
Because you all sit about and say, oh, yeah, let's form a band, but no one actually does it, if you know what I mean. But we did, and we got like 20-odd people turning up for kickabout, and we thought, let's take it to a stage further.
And actually, the thing that worked was because we were all like with different groups outside.
I mean, it was full of musicians.
Full of misfits, really, wasn't it?
But it wasn't about music, was it?
No.
Because, like, I don't think I ever once talked about music with you. It wasn't about that. It was about love of football, really.
Yeah,
and actually keep you fit at that age. And all of these musicians were registered properly with the club. And we started out wearing white T-shirts, had no kit. And then I asked Mickey Virtue, who's the keyboard player in UB40, to Mick, grab some money for a kit.
And Mickey turned up the first game with this brilliant new strip with Depp International.
That's right, yeah.
On the shirts, yeah, because that was UB's record company.
And it was red, gold and green.
Yeah.
And we used to play, and people go, where are you guys from? We're from Hollywood, mate.
And how serious was the football?
It was actually quite serious at the end, honestly. When we first started, we didn't know what we were doing, to be fair. We'd be like a swarm of bees going in and out. And then we got good. I mean, really good. We had proper set plays. And honestly, Paul, we were decent. And everyone knew what they were doing after a bit. I always loved that time, to be honest. I really did. I thought it was quite special.
Oh, it was very important. The highlight of my week, really.
The thing I loved about it, in all seriousness, was it's Collins, but we were all misfits, really. We weren't like your regular players. We were just a bit weird, man. Everyone was a bit strange. But everyone was a bit handy as well, so we didn't really care, did we, Carl?
You both have described the team as made up of misfits. Was that an important part of the identity? I know that Tony has felt a bit of an outsider in terms of his whole upbringing.
I didn't join Lytle till the second year.
Did you?
Yeah.
I didn't know
so
that.
So I always felt a little bit odd.
Did you feel like an outsider?
Yeah. I used to play every single sport possible.
Yeah, you did. You were really sporty, actually. So my problem was, because I was in a home, I couldn't do that stuff. You know, no one would take me to games and stuff like that. But it wasn't something I wore. I never used to talk to people about it.
Yeah, well, like I say, I didn't know.
There's a point when I was seeing Cole twice a week. It's really weird. We never talked about gigs or bands or anything.
I mean, you didn't tell people about your upbringing as such. I mean, Colin, what do you think?
I was a bit shocked. Not shocked, I was like surprised, really. And then I listened to your podcast and got me there, man.
Oh, God.
Because you're such a happy, well-balanced individual.
Yeah, but that's the point, you know, I had to be. And you know what life was like when we were younger. It was just like a different world, wasn't it? And, you know, people talk about racism and race now. You know, it was me in Shirley. And we lived in a time where it was a bit punchy, you know what I mean? It was like, you know, National Front, British Movement stuff. And everyone would go, no, Tone's all right. They weren't racist. They just didn't know.
Yeah, yeah. Ignorant. Yeah.
It was ignorance because no one travels anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
Throughout this time, I was still working. As I became more confident, as I grew up, if you like, my horizons and ambitions broadened. Football and music were no longer enough. I gradually saw I needed to move on. But there was a bigger canvas and a more challenging project to concentrate on. My life. But without the highs and lows of my time in music and playing football, I don't think I'd have been able to reach that point. There were lots of us who had been there a long time, so I was part of Ally Carpet's family in that shop. And in fact, when I left, it was a real wrench for me to leave. I left because I knew that I couldn't spend my whole life here. Honestly, it would have just been terrible. It was like jumping from a huge diving board for me to leave there. It was so terrifying to think, oh my gosh, who's going to give me a job? I had no qualifications, you know. I was black. It was 1982, 83. If they'd have made me a salesman, I may have stayed. I'd have gone to get a little house in, you know, somewhere in South Birmingham. I may have got married, raised a family, and that would have been it. And actually, I wouldn't have been sad. That's what I thought my life was. But deep down, because of music and because I knew there was another world out there, I just thought, oh, I think I can do something else. I think. I didn't know. I just think I could. So the biggest risk I ever took in my life was leaving Ally Carpets, not leaving corporate firms I do now or taking a big job. The biggest risk I ever took was leaving that shop because I left everything behind and I left everything everybody thought was right for me behind. Because a lot of people would have thought, Tony's got his job at Ally Carpets. He can now become a salesman, get a house, and he's, oh, thank God for that. That's one we got out of the system. But I forced myself to be uncomfortable again to try and just move to be happy. Does that make sense? It was quite terrifying. And then after that, I think it's when I first saw an ad in a paper for a proper job. And I went for the interview with the recruitment company and the recruiter said to me, I'm going to take a chance on you. I've never sent anyone like you before for a job like this. Go for the interview and make sure you come across to them like you did to me. Don't let me down. Because I don't want them to think that I'm just sending any black goods for these jobs. And so, you know, I'd borrowed a suit, ill-fitting suit. And I think I was quite good. I think I probably wore a white shirt and a blue tie. I didn't go garish. I remember the guy saying to me in the interview, yeah, well, I'm going to risk it with you, Tony. I think you could do it. Don't let me down. We've never hired anybody like you before, but I think you can do it. These were all common responses I had going for jobs in the 1980s. And by someone like you, I knew they meant black. In every case I can remember, just as with the Bernardo's home in Wildmoor Road, with my primary and secondary schools, and with Ally Carpets, I was always the first black person. But it wasn't them I didn't want to let down. It was myself. I wanted to be seen for who I was, not for what people thought I was. And this, I now know, was something that was again forged at Wildmoor Road. It was so normal for me, I was unconscious of it, if that makes sense. It would have been strange for me to be in an environment where there were people of colour in a workplace then. I'd thought, oh, it's not just me. It was just always me. I did an article on tokenism a couple of weeks ago at my day job. And in those days, it was reverse, really. Unfortunately, I couldn't be a token, so I had to perform. It was easier not to hire me than to hire me. And if people hired me, I had to be a top performer.
But were there ever times that you got angry about it?
No, I didn't get angry about it. How I dealt with it was by being better than everybody else. and proving that I was better. I didn't get angry about it because there was no point. I'd learned that a long time ago. And so I worked really hard. I probably worked harder than most people just to be level with them.
Did you see yourself as a trailblazer? Did you see yourself as a representative of the black community? Because you were talking about you didn't want to let yourself down.
Yeah, no, I didn't see myself as a representative of the black community. I did see myself as a trailblazer. But in those days, it's really interesting. I remember times where I'd been making meetings to see somebody and people walk out their office into the reception room looking around for Tony Simpson. I'd be like, no, that's me. And they'd be like, oh, OK. And at that moment, I knew exactly what they meant and they knew exactly what they meant. They're a bit embarrassed and I'm thinking, great, I can use this to my advantage now. Half of them think, oh, gosh, that's a bit embarrassing. They gave me the work and I give them every opportunity to give me the work because I know how to sell. Or otherwise, it's going to be a problem I know from day one. Honestly, I had that all the time. So it makes you quite adaptable and culturally fluid. I was culturally very fluid. I knew England, bizarrely enough, and Britain really well, but I was always on the outside looking in. But I was also on my way. Finally, I felt I was someone, even if I was at the beginning of a much longer and tougher journey. So at 25, I was wearing a suit, going to work every day. I was working on the Hagley Road in Birmingham, which was the business district. I was on the 14th floor, and I thought, wow. I used to sit in my swivel chair as if I was on Dallas, down, 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 thinking, I've made it. And yet I hadn't. I had no collateral. I was living in a rented house. My car was a company car. But from a societal perspective, I'd made that leap, you know, away from guys I'd been to school with who were still apprentices or still doing those type of jobs. I'd actually got a white-collar job. And I realised I could do it through my personality and through sales. But in my darkest hours, I'd always think if I had nightmares, I was always waking up back in alley carpets with everyone going, yeah, we told you you'd be back, Tony. You're one of us, mate, don't worry about it. And me going, yeah, no, I know, but bloody hell, I nearly got away with it. Those were my nightmares, very real nightmares. That's how I'd think. As I look back and reflect on the first four episodes of this podcast, I can see more clearly the thread of insecurity that grew out of my early years and how it has driven me to carve out a career and a life beyond what that young man in his late teens and early 20s could even comprehend. I can also see those formative years continue to shape how I live my life today. This was brought home to me in 2003. I was in South Africa, invited by a global charity to attend the birthday celebrations of Nelson Mandela. On our way to the event, the VIP delegation, of which I was a member, made a detour to a South African orphanage. As we walked in, flanked by officials, I saw rows of small black children sitting at desks, wearing their Sunday best, waiting expectantly for the dignitaries. It was at this point that I left the group, stepped over the barrier and sat with the children, holding back the tears. I was profoundly moved. The past never leaves you. It always catches up with you when you least expect or want it to. And that, rather than the festivities and the handshaking that followed, is my abiding memory of meeting Nelson Mandela. You've been listening to Resilience, A Life in Care. For more information about Bernardo's Oral History Project, visit their website at www.bernardos.org.uk/oral-history. In the next episode, we wrap up the series with a final look back and a nod to the future. Shall I tell you a funny story? It is a funny story, but it involves Ali Carp. You don't have to put it in the programme.
Switch the engine.
Oh, yeah, I'll tell you. So every night coming out of Alley Carpets, there's a bus stop across the road, just on the top of Solihull Road, it's called. And like today, it would be pouring with rain a lot of the time. And every now and then, I used to get a lift as I came to work from a woman who worked in the builder's yards here. And one night, it was pouring with rain, and the bus stop was so packed. I was at the back of that soaked, and I couldn't believe it. This woman came, she must have been about, you know, in her 40s, came and just honked the horn, and I thought, oh my God, thank God for that, I've got a lift down here. So I just jumped the queue, opened the front door, got into the car, and shut the door. And as I sat in there, the back door opened, and her daughter got in the car and sat in the back. And To be fair to them, they got off and started driving down the road towards where I lived. And I looked at her and just thought, oh, no, it wasn't for me. And they didn't say a word. It must have been 2 miles, Paul. Got to my house, opened the door and said, thank you. And they said, okay. And the daughter got out the back and sat back in the front and none of us said a word. And she never picked me up again, but that happened at the bus stop over here. True story. Yeah, God. Shirley, bloody hell. Is she going to get my burger now?
You can have your burger now.
Oh dear. Honestly, always whenever I see the bus stop, I'm like, oh my God. I am still embarrassed about that, yeah.